Today is June 30th, and I'm talking with Rear Admiral Mitch Noyce. We, last time we were talking about training, and you wanted to continue, and you mentioned that you'd taken a flying course.
Yes, that, we took a month's flying course during our midshipman's time. In HMS Argus, which at that time was the oldest carrier in the Royal Navy and was being used in the English Channel as the deck landing training carrier. She was in dry dock in Portsmouth when we joined her for our month's training with midshipmen from all over the Atlantic Fleet. So we were sent across each day to the naval air station at Leon Solent. And at that time, quite a number of Canadian officers serving in the Royal Air Force were training for carrier flying from that station. We flew from there in every type of naval aircraft. And then when we went to sea in the Argus, we also flew off her, and in those days she carried seaplanes as well, and once or twice we were lowered in a seaplane by her crane and flew off the water. All of this gave us a very comprehensive idea of carrier and seaplane flying in the Navy in those days in 1929. One interesting event that occurred quite frequently while we were in the Argus was the first deck landing carried out by various RAF officers at sea. And it was interesting to note that that was the only time when every single officer in the ship appeared to be stationed around the perimeter of the landing surface of the old ship, watching these young lads make their first attempt. And I must say, with one or two exceptions, they did an extremely good job. By the end of March 31, we had completed our 5 years of training in the Royal Navy, and I sailed for home that month via New York for my foreign service leave, and then joined HMCS Champlain in Halifax early in June. I relieved then Lieutenant Hugh Francis Pullen, one of my oldest friends from Oakville, who had just completed his 2 years in the ship, and he was already selected to return to the United Kingdom to undergo the long gunnery course at Weyland. This was a standard pattern in the RCN at that time. You, after your 2 or 3 years in a destroyer at home, you would apply for, and if selected, would be sent to the United Kingdom for a long course which usually lasted for a year. When I joined the ship, the total officer complement in the small destroyer was 5 officers. Our captain was Lieutenant Commander Pressey, and First Lieutenant, Lieutenant Commander Barnes. I was the sub-lieutenant. Mr. G, on loan from the Royal Navy, was the gunner, and Lieutenant Cohane was the engineer officer, or as normally called the chief. Shortly after joining the Champlain, which was a small World War I destroyer, which with HMCS Vancouver on the West Coast had been loaned by the Royal Navy to the RCN. An exciting and significant event took place in the RCN. My first trip to sea in one of our own destroyers was out of Halifax Harbor in June 1931 to meet the first two destroyers ever built and paid for by the Canadian government. These were modern, ice-strengthened adaptations of the latest RN A-class destroyers, and they had been proudly named after two of our great rivers. They were the first HMCS Skeena and the first HMCS Saguenay. As midshipmen, as sub-lieutenants, we had seen them both under construction at the Southampton Yard of Thornycroft and Sons, who built destroyers for the Royal Navy ever since destroyers came into existence. They were beautifully built ships and had been commissioned that spring, the spring of 31. Commander Brodeur was the captain of Skeena, and Commander Percy Nellis was captain of Saguenay. We steamed out of Halifax Harbor and never saw anything until we picked up both these ships at anchor off from Cap Shoal in a thick pea soup fog. We had taken Commodore Walter Hose out with us, and on arrival at the anchorage, we transferred the Commodore and his staff to the Saguenay for passage up the harbor. As we passed Major's Beach Light at the entrance to Halifax Harbor, the fog rolled away and the three ships proudly steamed up Halifax Harbor to the dockyard. Then followed 3 days of people who had not seen one another for many years getting together, and after that Skeena left for the West Coast, which was to be her normal home for some years. Then we started our normal summer and fall routine of training in Canadian waters. It was interesting, on looking back, to realize that in all the nearly 3 years I served in the Champlain from 31 to 34, we never visited a single American port. This routine, of course, has changed very drastically, and quite rightly. I think one reason was probably the monetary situation, and our fuel allowance was at such a low ebb that we combined training with paying visits to our own ports, which were very good relations, made for good relations around the coast. Having joined the ship as a sub-lieutenant with 6 months to go for my watchkeeping ticket, I found I was the navigator, gunnery officer, signal officer, seaman's divisional officer, officer of the watch, and officer of the day in harbor, usually one in three watches, and just to keep me busy in spare time, I was also the wardroom wine caterer. That was normal routine with small destroyers with only five officers. The chief had played in his department. The gunner looked after all the ammunition and magazines, etc., and was also in charge of our main armament, which of course were the torpedoes in the destroyer. Old Champlain had 3 4-inch guns, and believe it or not, only 2 21-inch torpedo tubes.
How big was the coffin?
At that time, it was, I think, between 95 and 100, all told. Now, all summer and partly in the fall, we were augmented in ship's company by reserves coming down from every place east of the lakehead. And they were, of course, a great help and got very intensive training during usually their 2 weeks or 10 days of training. This was another reason, of course, under the stringent economic situation and services, why we stayed between Halifax and Montreal during our summer training period, which of course was the main period for the reserve officers and men. By this time, the RCNBR was very well established, thank goodness, in the service, and we were never short of trainees, particularly in this time of very severe depression in the country. As I said, we visited everywhere, I suppose I should say, from St. John, New Brunswick, right around the coast, as far as Montreal, which was Montreal and Quebec were naturally a much looked forward to excursion up the river. And it makes me smile now because it was very much looked forward to by the captain and the navigator. As in those days, we followed the RN practice of never taking a pilot unless we were forced to by regulations. And if you were in narrow waters, such as the Upper St. Lawrence, you applied for and received a pilotage allowance. It was my job as the navigator to work out that from a table, submit it to the captain, and if the captain followed the normal practice, when the check came in some months later, he divided it between himself, who had the responsibility, and the navigator, who did all the Joe work and was his right-hand man in this office. Sometimes when you've been up the river and back, it became quite a reasonable extra bit of pay. Now, in the time I was in the ship, we, as I say, visited a great many Canadian ports, from St. John, Digby, Shelburne, Arrowshat, and all the way up and down the coast. In those days, we didn't normally visit Newfoundland. Newfoundland was not part of Canada. Skeena did during the period I was in the ship, but that was a special visit of hers. That's Saguenay, rather, not Skeena. One thing we did do each summer was proceed to the Brador Lakes, probably one of the most beautiful lake districts in the world. And there we carried out our torpedo and gunnery exercises for the summer. I'm never quite sure why the Brador Lakes were chosen, as they're relatively small and, of course, normally very calm. There was just room to fire torpedoes safely, and in those days it was safe to fire 4-inch and 4.7-inch guns as well in the big lake. But it was not the best of training because we were training for war at sea in the broad Atlantic. But from the point of view of everybody concerned, it was a very pleasant place to be in for a couple of weeks in July, and we did our night firings as well, which must have shaken the inhabitants around the edge of the lake with a star shell, etc. Another innovation which had started about the time I joined was the arrival, before we sailed on our summer cruise, of a small number of RMC cadets joined for a month's training. Previously, in the summer, the RMC cadets had done artillery training at Petawawa and in the early 30s, it was decided to give them an opportunity of doing their summer training either with the Army, which was traditional, of course, or the Air Force at Camp Borden, or the Navy. And as the youngest executive officer in the ship, not unnaturally, during the time these fine young men were aboard the ship, I was their divisional officer. We had no gunroom in a destroyer, and perforce they lived and slung their hammocks in the worst possible place, in the tiller flat, where the steering machinery and all the spare gear for a ship of that size was stowed. But it didn't seem to faze them, because I can always remember one of the great sights is the very formal Sunday division seeing six immaculately turned out cadets in their scarlet uniforms and pillboxes coming out of the hatch from the tiller flat of their ship. How they did it, I don't know to this day, but it was good training for everybody concerned. And they added a distinct fillip both aboard and socially when we had them with us. And that was great fun training. In 31, I wasn't much older as a sub-lieutenant than some of the senior ones were who came for training. At this time, the Depression had really settled in all too grimly in Canada. And as I mentioned before, we were very seriously curtailed in our movements in order to serve fuel, which cost money. And later on, we had the doubtful, the doubtful experience of receiving a signal from headquarters asking us if we would mind taking a 10% pay cut. In those days, the seaman wasn't getting much more than about $1.30 a day, the able seaman. So it was a pretty grim request, but naturally, we couldn't do anything about it anyway, so that was that. But that was right across the board, and that was that. We usually came back for a couple of weeks leave in August before starting off on our fall program, which again was concentrated training of all kinds at sea. And as I mentioned, the great advantage at the time I joined was having our lovely new big destroyer, the Saguenay, with us. We were the junior ship, somewhat naturally, but the training that can be done by two ships as opposed to one is well more than 100%. It is makes all the difference in the world, as we could do any kind of station keeping, throw off chutes. We had a ready target either way, and there was a competition naturally engendered by having two ships together for sailing races, boat pulling, etc., etc. By the middle of October, or towards the end of it, the weather had begun to deteriorate in the Atlantic to the extent that we normally would come back and go into either an annual or a self-refit in Halifax, one ship at a time, of course, so the other would be available for any emergency requirements. People would finish up the remainder of their leave, and men could be sent to the various schools for the junior courses. I mentioned junior courses because the technical courses over the sort of lowest grades were still being taken in the appropriate RN schools in England, such as Whale Island for gunnery and Vernon for torpedo men and Victory for signalmen. This was because we had so few men in the Navy that we didn't have enough people to set up big schools, and there wouldn't have been enough applicants for the courses to do them anyway. So it was an economic thing to send them. When the men went over to the UK for their courses, they quite often would be sent to battleships and cruisers for a short time in order to put what they learned into practice before coming back to their destroyers. And then, of course, they just became normal members of the ship's company again.
Were you aware of any financial arrangement between the Government of Canada and the Royal Navy or Government of England?
The financial arrangement, because we paid the bills for those men. That was just as had for us. The RCN, long before this, had picked up the tab for training. We were just on loan to the Royal Navy for the time we were there.
So when you served on a Royal Navy ship, were you paid by the RCN or the RN?
Oh, no, we were paid by the RCN, and we had different pay. It wasn't all that much. For instance, when we were midshipmen, we received the princely sum of $2 a day all found, and they thought we were bloated plutocrats, because a midshipman then, I think, was getting 5 shillings a day. They were also all seemed to have some little private allowances, but that wasn't necessarily universal. But and the same with the men. The men, you were paid by your own government, and as I say, the government also obviously paid the
tuition
fees, which were worked out. I never knew the details at that time. I wasn't sort of, I was a recipient of them rather than responsible for that part of the training. But it was a very life-saving agreement, and I don't think we'd have existed without it. We just didn't have the facilities or anything else to do the type of training. And they were all there, and being Commonwealth Navy, we were more than welcome. And all during the 30s, a very large proportion of the officers in the Royal Canadian Navy were actually serving in ships and establishments, mostly ships in the Royal Navy. Most of my senior officers that I knew had at one time or another served for at least a commission in the Mediterranean Fleet, which in the 30s, of course, was the great fleet of the world. Now, when we were in harbor, usually as I from for the November December period, which on the East Coast is pretty grim weather wise but there was lots to be done, and Christmas leave, of course, was one important break for the men, and we played hockey if the winter set in early enough, and a good deal of rugger, which was and still is the form of football played, and soccer played in that part of the world. We also got a chance to meet our opposite numbers in the Army. They're mostly coastal artillery in those days, and one company of the Royal Canadian Regiment, which was then stationed in what is now the HMCS Stadacona. We started our new year usually fairly early, the first week in January. Both ships would leave Halifax for almost 5 months of intensive training and showing the flag in the West Indies and Bermuda en route. As you can imagine, Halifax in November and December is not exactly the easiest place to keep a ship looking tiddly. So the normal routine was that everybody back from leave about the 10th of January, I'll give a perfect sort of example with the first cruise, Saguenay and Champlain left for Bermuda. As usual, we ran into a westerly gale which tested both ships, and I can always remember my captain's remarks when Saguenay, the brand new big destroyer, made a signal the first night out when we were heading into a very big sea, saying, do you wish me to slow down? We looked at Saguenay and she was rolling and making much heavier weather of it than little Champlain, which just happened to be one of the finest sea boats in the world, I think. So the captain made her appropriate remark back again with his tongue in his cheek. Bermuda was normally an excellent place to pause and paint ship and get ready for the West Indies cruise. We would go alongside in the dockyard there and thoroughly enjoy our usually 2 weeks of both not exercising at that point, but just cleaning up and getting ready to go south. From there, we would normally proceed straight to the West Indies, calling at such places as Trinidad, St. Kitts, Dominica, Barbados, Jamaica, Bahamas, and on one occasion, Puerto Rico. Quite often, and quite rightly, when we were showing the flag and visiting these islands, which as you remember were at that time also connected by the wonderful service of the CNS lady boats, we'd split up and each ship would visit one island and then join for exercises. We were exercising all the time, either individually at harbor as well as at sea, because again, it was the question of the limitation on oil fuel. If we hadn't had that, we'd have been at sea an awful lot more, but we just didn't have the oil fuel to be at sea all the time. And there was a great deal of training which was carried on because in our way, in our Navy, we were training our young ordinary seamen, and so we were somewhat like my first ship, the HMS Emperor of India. We were a small ordinary seamen's training ship as well as training the whole ship's company as a ship's company. So there was lots of work to be done at all times. When you got south, you normally worked tropical routine, which made sense in the hot climates of the West Indies. It meant that you started work at 5:30 in the morning and finished at 12 or 12:30 and then could give leave in the afternoon. The amount of work done still remained the same, and it was beneficial for all concerned. Trinidad was usually our, in those days, was our furthest south, and it was also in the days before the harbor had been built there, so we lay off nearly a mile from the landing jetty. Trinidad was the worst in the respect of distances to travel. So with a small 25-foot motorboat and a whaler, it made quite a job getting people ashore and back when they did go on leave, so the longer time they had ashore, the better. The only place we normally would be alongside in the West Indies, actually, was in Kingston, Jamaica, where we would go for a couple of days and then go out in the stream because it was so damned hot alongside that it was better to be out at anchor, but you were very close to the beach in Kingston Harbor. While we were in the West Indies, that is late January, February, March, we would normally do a 4 or 5 day exercise with the ships of the American West Indies Squadron. And this was extremely beneficial and was carried out at high speeds. It was a real war exercise with all the normal things of darken ship at night, etc., and carrying out exercising at high speed with 3 or 4 cruisers and the odd sloop. At that time, the American West Indies Squadron was responsible in its area, which went from the North Pole to the South Pole and encompassed both North America and South America. And we were fortunate enough to have, as our opposite numbers, the magnificent D-class cruisers of that era. Towards the end of March, middle of March, we would start working our way north to the dockyard in Bermuda again. And this was when the American West Indies Squadron also came home from their year of showing the flag around both Americas. And at that time, we also had a concentrated exercise program. We did 2 or 3 weeks of torpedo firing, gunnery, exercising with the squadron, and as the climax, they always held their fleet regatta, to which we were naturally cordially invited. It was a time when we could all get together, see old friends, and play games with them.
What sort of games did you play?
We'd play cricket, tennis, soccer, and if you were strong, and rugger. At that time, Admiral Budge, who was then the torpedo gunner's mate in the Saguenay, produced the first war canoe, I think, ever produced in a Canadian ship. It was naturally only the whaler, but he piled an incredible number of men into it with paddles from the Carley floats. Our opponents in this particular race were called the all-comers race, in which you could pile as many people into any ship's boat you wanted, and no holds were barred. It caused quite a stir, but I regret to say that the slimline gig of HMS Dragon, I think it was, won the race with about 25 people in short oars pulling that particular boat. They'd even added about 5 feet onto her stern so they could take more people in the coxswain. But it was a lot of fun and very good for everybody concerned. We also did a lot of sailing in Bermuda too, which was ideal for that type of work. We then would leave for home about the end of April, early in May, for annual leave and a self-refit, and that's the way the circle went. At the end of 6 months in the ship, I was given my watchkeeping certificate by the captain and immediately became a lieutenant. And that was the normal routine. It was a good idea not to give it to you automatically, for the simple reason that it gave the captain 6 months to sum up your ability to be capable of being on your own as off the watch of a, whether it be a destroyer or a huge aircraft carrier. And I'm sure that he slept, as they always do, with one eye half open during the time you were on watch. I should add too here that maybe because of the depression, but not necessarily, we always carried as many reserve officers and men as we could on the West Indies cruise. This meant for them, of course, getting a 4 or 5 month leave of absence. And looking back, the companies for whom they worked were extremely cooperative and long-sighted that in giving them this without any loss of pay or seniority. And they weren't paid, I guess, when they were away, but they were very good to the services. We were the main users of it at that time because we had to take them away from their jobs for some time. Also, at that time, the other reserves, of course, would come to the schools in the dockyard in Halifax, in HMCS Stadacona, where the barracks was then situated in the yard, and do shore training. This was always a great hockey period when we were away in Halifax, particularly with the Charlottetown Division, who used to bring over their entire hockey team with them, and much to the dismay of anybody in the Halifax area, because it just so happened that in the early 30s that the Charlottetown Divisional Hockey Team were almost as good as they were. A lot of them were of senior OHA Allen Cup caliber. That usually caused a slight disaster amongst the local teams in Halifax in the 2 weeks they were doing their training. Another reserve who did training during that period were RCNR, that's Royal Canadian Naval Reserve, the seagoing element of the reserve establishment in Canada and in England, of course. And most of them came from the lady boats. And they would be left for a round trip of a lady boat. They'd leave off one or two of their crew, and they would be able to do their required training in the school to upgrade their knowledge. And in odd cases, they would even loan them to us in the ships. But most of the ship training was done by the RCNVR reservists, as opposed to the seagoing ones who were at sea anyway. Let's just have a quick rest here. By the RCNVR reservist, as opposed to the seagoing ones who are at sea anyway. Let's just have a quick rest here.